Welcome back to The How, Channeling Water Solutions, a podcast from W12 Plus program. The How focuses on water solutions and the people behind them from around the world. In this third season, we are excited to bring to you a series of 6 episodes highlighting locally led organizations and their work in water, sanitation, and hygiene across Ethiopia, Ghana, and Uganda.
Each episode brings a story of a local organization and its people. The stories highlight pressing water challenges in their communities and how these locally led organizations are addressing them. They are locally led, community-driven water solutions.
I'm your host, Kajal.
And I'm your host, Anna. Kajal, in this episode, you spoke with Delwin Bawa Mansour and Samuel Nayang from Future for Africa. Can you tell us a bit about Future for Africa and their work?
Future for Africa is a nonprofit and non-governmental organization in Bolgatanga in the Upper East region of Ghana. Future for Africa focuses on improving access to clean water, sanitation, health, and education with a focus on local, tribal, and Fulani nomads communities.
From listening in, I also understand that Future for Africa has adopted the asset-based community development ABCD model, which promotes best practices in sustainable development to mobilize a community's own assets and resources as the basis for development.
That's right. Future for Africa is a young organization that is pushing for the sustainable growth and development for their region. Their commitment to innovation and collaboration has garnered recognition and demand for their services.
Thanks, Kajal. Let's listen in and learn more about Future for Africa.
Well, water issues often have deep human elements. Can you share with us how did you got involved in water issues and what do you do in water sector?
Okay, so first off, my name is Nayang Samuel. It's always been a great pleasure working within the water sector. I mean, looking back at the community that we work with now, and I mean, which is also a community that we grew up in, seeing the struggle that most of the very local people go through, you realize that over the years, the challenges keep getting, I mean, we are solving them, but there's still a lot of people that are in some of the crises that it's really disheartening. And I've always had the joy to be in, a role that will create that access for many of such communities. And that's been the driving force to work in the sector.
Okay, with me, in 2012, we went to a community that was close to Burkina Faso. And then we went with our education project. And then when we got there, we realized that the school attendance for the girl child was very low. And then when we later did our research, we found that it was because the girls have to walk miles in search of water. So it was affecting their education. And so it's motivated me to go in because I realized that even providing water, we're also helping girls and other people stay in the classroom as well.
Yes, that's interesting because seeing water issues around you definitely inspires someone to work towards it. Can you tell us a bit about your organization and what initiatives your organization work on water-related issues?
All right, so Future for Africa, it's a youth-led organization, as you rightly said, based in the northern part of Ghana, the Upper East region of Ghana. We basically started as an organization inspired to solve educational needs for children. And as Delwin said, that also drove us with the inspiration to give water access to water because we realized that there was a huge gap between access to water and then education. So we've been doing some very impactful projects in education. We also do some projects in health. We've been organizing some health outreaches in very marginalized communities to help them in identifying some of the basic things that's worrying them. Some of them are unable to access, or have free medical consultation. Some of them don't even have the fare to come to the hospital. So we move ourselves into these communities and we're able to give them free medical attention. And as we are talking about water now, we've seen that great need to bridge that gap as well. So we are also working in the area of water Also, we are empowering women within these communities. We have a women empowerment project called Poker Straw that identifies some of these women with who are very skillful with making straw baskets. Well, Gatanga is known for its beautiful baskets. So we're able to help these women to make these baskets to fit their global market. And we're able to market these baskets and these profits come to help them and also the organization.
Okay, our water projects too, we focus more on providing water for marginalized groups like the Fulani. And we are working with about three Fulani communities. That is about 1,000 people or more. And then providing this, we are bridging the gap between, in Zebila district, we have the Fulani groups and also the normal ethnic group. And so by providing this water facilities, we are encouraging coexistence within these two groups. And then we are solving an issue about coexistence and living peacefully together so that they have a place that they can all connect to access the same facilities at the same time.
From your conversation, it seems Future for Africa is focused on very basic needs, education, health, water, ethnic disputes. And what are some of the major water challenges that you have seen in Ghana and realities you encounter on ground in Upper East region of Ghana? Also, do you see any water intersection with other global challenges like climate change, food insecurity, economic inequality?
There's a lot of challenges on the ground. I mean, if you come to the northern part of Ghana, you realize that the poverty levels are high. And for that matter, every little resource is of major importance. So when we have issues of, climate change, which is negatively affecting the people, the lives of the people there, having a huge impact on the kind of water they have access to, and even to the a larger extent, even on food security, it heightens the level of poverty in the area, and that needs to be given a critical eye or attention.
And also surface mining and around Sapeliga area in the Upper East region is also affecting the water system. And also it makes even going to these communities to drill these boreholes even a challenge as well.
And what do you think, what are the sources, the root cause of this water challenges? Like one you said is probably mining, you said?
Yes, surface mining.
Surface mining.
Because they do this, in the south of Ghana, it's called Galamse. But in the north, we call it surface mining because it's not really done in the water bodies, but it's done on the open, which is not regulated. And so it really affects the water system.
So can we say Galamse is illegal mining that's happening
yes.
in Ghana?
Yes. So Galamse is illegal mining. That's the word we use for in Ghana. And people go into river bodies to get gold because Ghana is one of the leading producers of gold in the world. So we have a great challenge with this. And now it's even affecting the water basin from the Pra River. It's now even going into the sea. So we're having a very huge challenge in Ghana now because if you go to some parts of the south, you find that even the sea is turning brown, which is really sad with some of the challenges that we are facing. So it's interwoven, and then it also affects even people up north.
So the issue with Galamse, it's a serious national mess. And just a few weeks ago, I joined a demonstration just to add my voices to lots of young Ghanaians that believe that if our water bodies are not prioritized and government actions are not adequate, probably the next few years is going to be we don't know, we might be drinking very contaminated water. I mean, it's already contaminated. I mean, knowing now the level of poisonous substances like cyanide and also heavy metals like mercury and lead inducing these water bodies, it's a big worry. I mean, they can do some cleanup, some purification with maybe chlorine, alum, just to get the water and the surface of the water looking clean, thus solving the turbidity level and all that. But then you realize that heavy metals probably cannot be removed from water easily, and it comes at a very great cost. That's probably government already, which is not doing so much, is not ready to foot. So at the end of the day, we realize that we are in a big mess as a country, and lots of action need to be done in this particular area for us to have our water bodies back.
And from the information that you just provided, seems that the issue seems very, very complex, because it's, on one hand, it's polluting water sources, rivers, and now it's affecting the seas, all the water bodies is affecting, the surface water, the groundwater is affecting, and you mentioned the soil is getting, the land is getting more affected in the northern region, and the water bodies in southern region. And from what you're saying, it seems it's very, very difficult to treat this water that's already polluted because of illegal minings.
Exactly.
Sure. And even now, the Ghana Water Company, I also find it difficult to purify this water. So in the future, we are going to pay more for water, because they have to treat this water with, and they need huge funding. So we will still pay more for water as well.
And I also read that some of the water treatment plants had to be shut down because of Galamse.
Yes.
Okay, that's very, very complex.
And on top of that, so there's a great vast difference between Northern Ghana and Southern Ghana. And mostly people think stuff happening in Southern Ghana probably doesn't really affect Northern Ghana. With the current situation with Galamse, for example, I mean, we send foodstuff from Northern Ghana to Southern Ghana. And likewise, some food crops or whatever are grown down south, that also moved up north. So if most of these crops are dependent on this water to be able to grow, that means we are more or less also poisoning our food. And most of this food also gets up north. And now people even in the diaspora that even buy food that comes from our country are also at huge risk. So we realize that we are really in a big mess. And if for nothing, fighting for our water resources to be managed very well should have been the last thing, we should be calling for.
It's very sensitive thing. And you also mentioned that government also needs to incur huge funding to treat this, to stop this. What are your personal funding challenges that you have faced?
Okay, so for Future for Africa, we've been doing our best over the years. Of course, just like every other organization, funding has been a huge gap. But notwithstanding that, we've tried as much as possible to go around and find our own source of making some income. And with the capacity building we are getting here, we are hoping we are able to scale up even more. So funding has been a major challenge. We've been having huge calls from the communities communities closer to those we've already made interventions for. And they are making huge cries because they also want some intervention in one way or the other. So there's more or less like some snowballing going on. One community hears, okay, you're dreadful, this community we are also in need. And because we have limited funds, we are not able to go in to drill for all these communities. So, that has been, for me, a major headache.
And you mentioned about community. Can you share in detail an example of a project that Future for Africa have been involved with and that addresses this water challenges and its impact on the communities?
Right from the genesis, top of it has been providing water for the Fulani communities. You realize that their situation is more dicey because the normal communities usually don't even have access. And the fact that they are not even one way or the other regarded makes it even more challenging for them. So we being able to go in to drill for these people has been, I think I lost grip of the question, sorry.
just an example of an impact that project, Future for Africa project, is making on these communities.
Exactly, sure. So
some detail of one particular project.
So identifying the Fulani communities as one of the most marginalized has been of top topmost priority for us. As I said earlier, knowing the challenge they face and how it's even more harder for them to reach water. I mean, we've tried our best to engage them, know their situation, and also see how we can solve some of the challenges for them. So far, we've engaged with about three. One of them has already gotten, and we are hoping there are still more communities out there. We are trying to still identify and see how we can extend help to them.
Yeah. So these Fulani groups, they are nomadic people who use their cattle to move around Ghana. And so sometimes they go to a community and they can even stay there permanently whilst moving their cattle around. And so by providing these facilities like the boreholes for them, we are really helping them to have this access and also to be able to have healthy water as well.
Most of your projects are located very close to Burkina Faso border. So how is the international border and transboundary water management affecting your project and the local communities?
Okay, so I think talking about how the proximity to the border and our projects located there, we've not had so much challenges providing water for most of the communities there. In terms of shared borders and how water is being managed, I think it goes beyond just the boreholes we drill for the communities. I mean, in Burkina, there's a dam called Bagri Dam. Usually, every year it gets flooded or the spillage, yes. And they have to notify Ghana and then they allow the spillage. Most of this water can actually be turned into other innovative stuff, for agriculture and other things. But I realize that our country has no position itself to really make use of this water spillage. And the excesses is what affects us. So right now we have every year to deal with flooding in our area. So you go to the White Volta area, you realize that every year it floods and people that are farming around the banks of the river, the Volta River. Around Palugu.
I think when you were coming to Boga, when entering Boga, you could see a dam. That is the Palugu dam. So the water comes there and it causes a lot of havoc, and all the plants like maize and everything goes down because there's no proper communication between the government in Burkina Faso and Ghana as well. Even if there's communication, most people in these areas don't have access to phones and all that, so there's no proper communication, and so it really affects the people.
So both livestock, human lives, plants are always, at the bad, or let me just say, receiving end of this, which has a huge bad turn on the economy, or let me just say, the livelihoods of the people around the Upper East region.
So you're saying it's flooding every year?
Yes, so consistently it's been flooding every year. Even this year it got flooded.
Because Burkina, they have created a dam. And so when they are okay and it's too full, they open it. And
so is there no communication, or is there poor communication between the governments and then the community are not informed?
I think there's poor communication. Also, this communication is not disseminated to the people on the ground.
And has there been any efforts made to create any infrastructure for any protection?
I think there might be some intervention that we are not privy to, but probably it's that there's still more work to be done because for each year and then the hard work that keeps coming, I think a lot more needs to be done to avert some of these situations.
Because every year it happens.
Yeah, it's been persistent.
What are some of the important lessons that your organization have learned from being on the ground? Could be failures, struggles, achievements, or just some learnings?
I think some of the challenges that we face is information, access to information and data. Ghana, I don't know for other African countries, but Ghana, our access to information is very difficult. And so to be able to build upon what is already there, you have to go the extra mile to have the access to information. And this is one of the challenges that we are facing as an organization.
Yeah, just to throw more light on the data, for example, there's no real data on the number of Fulani, even though I know they're nomadic people, but there's some of them in some communities that are more or less settled. They come in and then they get to really love the place. And some of them have been staying in particular places for a very long time. And the fact that there's no significant data on these people makes it even hard to reach marginalized people like them and to have a more focused or targeted intervention for them.
So there is no information available from the government side, or it's the trust on the data is difficult, or there is no census data at all?
There is, but it's not adequate. Like you have to go the extra mile to have the information, and sometimes you have to rely on UN, an article or some publications that they have. And so if you have to rely on this, sometimes they are not also accurate. So you have to go in there and then do an extra work as a building point. So you have sometimes, even if you go to a department for an information, the system and the processes that you have to go is another huge difficulty as well. As well, that sometimes they don't even have the information. Even if they have it, it's not accurate.
But what about the basic data, that this is the population of this village, or this is the for water that, sources, it's available?
For that we have the information. Okay. I think the last census.
I think with what I know, there's no big consistency with keeping up to date with the, for example, the number of Fulanis that live maybe within communities in Ghana. So depending on the priorities of the census, sometimes from what I have read, there have been instances they've counted them and they've been instances. So I think in the past years, they've not been so much inclusion for the account. So there's no consistent data. So also talking about some of the things we've learned over the time, one thing I've learned that we have to persevere, whether there's some funding coming on. So, I mean, we are gearing up to get some huge funding. So over the years, probably if we were just solely just relying on grants and then they never came, or let's say, assuming everyone is good and is very competitive and we're just going to fold our arms. But having been persistent and trying to look for other channels has been one of the things that has kept us going. And I think it's a big lesson for us. Sometimes we really take inspiration in that and to just keep going. So for us, with this opportunity to annex very big projects, we're still going to keep up with the innovation round, other ways to self-generate funds to really do our project. So whether funds come, we're able to do something at least, because we can't always wait for funds to arrive, because there's human life at stake as far as water is concerned.
And what about the other stakeholders that's in the community, whether it's local government or the leader of the community, the water sector, the water department? What are their involvement in solving the issues?
So I think everyone is trying their best, you know. I might say probably maybe Delwin might share a different view, but I think for us, probably we've been in one corner. So there's a lot also going on we are not aware, because, I know government, true politicians are in one way drilling, but then they do it based on that incentive to come back to power, which is very bad. There are also other organizations that are doing one or two projects they are also doing projects, but then there should be a concerted effort to bring all of us together, that we're able to work and then be able to solve this crisis with water, as a whole, not in fragments or in silos. Yeah.
And what do you think about indigenous knowledge and traditional water management systems that plays a role in today's solutions? Do they play any role? Is it relevant?
Yes. So I think indigenous knowledge is really great. It's really important. Even before now, our forefathers have been managing our water resources very well, trying as much as possible to utilize their water body. But, indigenous knowledge might have its own challenges, but then with over time, what technology has come to be and how we're able to utilize technology to do a whole lot of things, we have a blend of indigenous knowledge and also that of contemporary ideas and technology, we could be solving a big gap between, that most of the communities are facing. And so for me, indigenous knowledge is really important because that's really kept us all this well. But with the emergence of technology and then contemporary knowledge, I think we can go further to protect our water resources and manage even everything around our water very much better.
And are indigenous people aware about the water crisis, the quality of water that they are drinking and the struggles that they are facing? Because when we were on ground, you also told us that sometimes they get a better water quality borehole, but they still drink from the old wells and the behavior change is very hard to...
All right. So that's the Zongoyiri experience. I think when you were in Ghana, we went to Zongoyiri. So Zongoyiri is a community in the Boko West district. We drilled for them about some 4 years ago. Before we got there, we realized that they were drinking from a hand dugout well that was open. You know, there was nothing closing it. There's all everything getting into this hand dugout well. We got in, they told us they needed water. Well, it turned out that some of them actually were happy with the project. They were using it, of course, but some of them couldn't part with the old borehole. They said that has been what their ancestors have been drinking. And for them, it tastes better to drink than. Yes, and it's quite interesting. Even till today, you get there and then they are still drinking. I think even on our last visit with you, they were still drinking from that source, even though what we had drilled was still used.
Sometimes you ask them and they tell you they don't drink it. Some of them tell you they don't drink it, they use for washing, but we never know because...
Yeah.
But do they fall sick when they drink this water or their bodies used to this or how?
Well, this question is very hard to answer. You know, over time, probably we might say maybe they built some immunes or something to this... kind of polluted water, but then they still drink it and then they find themselves still doing their daily activities. But for sure we all attest that drinking from such sources will have its own
but
impact.
During the very dry season where temperatures go up to 4 to 5 degrees, they have no option but than to use that water because it gets dry. It's not so deep.
Exactly. Sure. So now they have
almost half of the year or more, they depend on that borehole. If that borehole was not there, they will know they have to go miles or another place to search for water.
Water.
Or go to, I think, at that community, they are closer to the white water.
Yeah.
Close to Gambaga. So they go there.
They go there. It's a lot of miles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're constantly mentioning boreholes and White Water River. So what are the other sources of water, or there are no other sources of water, whether it's piped water or something that's done by government, or it's just this too because it's very deprived area?
Yeah, it's very, very deprived. And then the water pipe system basically is in the district capital, that is Zebila. And apart from Zebila, all the other communities depend on boreholes or open dugouts.
Yeah.
Or rainwater when it's rain. And from where we are coming from, there's a lot of climate challenges where the season is not as it used to be. And so there's no enough water.
And also just to add up to the sources of water. So in the capital of the Upper East region, which is Borga, it takes its main source of water from that's piped water that's treated and saved from the Via Dam, which the Ghana Water Company manages. So they pump water, but this water is not enough to reach every household. And to it, it's not even every household that can pay for what service the Ghana Water provides. So again, there's water being provided, but there's still a huge gap that needs to be covered.
Even in Borga Tanga, there are some areas that don't have 24 hours water. You can have water for 2 days, 3 days, and they cut it off, and then another 3 or 4 days, you don't have water. So growing up, we used to have that schedule.
Yeah,
so
even till now, you have people that are living in the city center, but we still have to move maybe to another area to fetch water.
And that is Borga. So imagine
the communities far.
So it's not a village problem, it's a regional problem.
It's a regional problem.
Not
problem.
Even having a tap water access
to the city. Exactly. And also just to add that there are also some communities, especially around the Bongo area, same place where the Via Dam is located. So there have been other interventions I know of other organizations that are drilling, but because of the high fluoride in the water there, I mean, they drill and then the people cannot even drink, or they drink and then they're having issues with their teeth and all that. So there are other challenges that come with it as well. So it's a bigger challenge.
When you're telling me that they drill boreholes, before that, what about water testing quality and then ensuring that it is a good quality?
So water quality, yes, is done. I think the Ghana Water Company does its own water test. But for individuals, organizations that are making water, they have to do their follow-up to make these water tests and make sure that the water available for the people to drink is actually that safe. So, well, I would say there's some efforts being done or being taken to ensure water quality tests.
I think. But our challenge too as an organization is having to depend solely on Ghana Water Company to test our water before we continue our construction projects on the water project.
Yes, yes.
So we have to wait for them to give us, like, to test the water to tell us, that, okay, the borehole that you've dug, you can continue and finish it. But then we have to wait, so it delays the process as well. And what we had today, the test will go a long way to also help us to be able to provide these facilities with time.
Because so currently there is only one organization, National Ghana Water Company, that's doing water quality testing, and
know,
no other private
It's more testified because they approve it and then
issue
Ghana Water. So.
Exactly. So just to add up to what Dawn is saying, so there are other channels like I think that's the research, the water research
institute.
Or something institute, yes. So they have an office in Tamale, not in Boulder. So for example, if they have to be some water test, they have to bring it to Accra to do that test. So you can imagine all this movement up and down, sometimes it delays. And if, let's say, as an organization like Delwyn is saying, you have to commence with your water project and you want to do due diligence, you have to wait all this while. So Ghana Water has been our best bet, but I mean, as to any other thing, maybe we just hope it gets better. Yeah.
And looking ahead, what are your thoughts about future of water management and sustainability in Ghana, in Bolga, in your experience?
I think if all the stakeholders play a responsible role, and because we cannot do it alone, it's something that's collective. And so if all the stakeholders play their role, from the government to NGOs, I think that the future is bright. But with our current challenges with Galamse and all that, we need strong government interventions to help us to solve this problem, because it's a basic human right. And if we lose it with water, then I don't think that the future will be bright. So we have to all rise up and then work together to solve these issues.
Sure. So for me, just like water is important to that man in town, to that other man in the last mile community, water is also very important. So within this value chain, everybody has a role to play, and we all, as Delwyn said, I mean, we have to have a concerted effort. All stakeholders must have their hands on deck, and also we should prioritize on partnership so that we can really evolve a lot of things. Also, that willpower from Ghana, as Delwyn rightly said, from government can really change a lot of things, because people can do everything that they want to, organizations can try so much, but if there's no government willpower to really avert or change the situation for its people, we might be working in circles, and probably we might all lose the vim or vigor within us, and we'll not even reach anywhere. So for me, it's important that we prioritize partnership and broad stakeholder consultation.
And are there any other important players or other focus areas that we might have missed in this discussion, whether it's international players or some other issues that's very interconnected with the water sector in Ghana?
Sure. So just recently, we got to also know of the coalition of NGOs in water. And I think they are playing a very huge role. Thanks to Ibrahim, we got introduced and all that. I think with the kind of high stakeholder engagement that goes on there and other networking and how open people within the sector are to solve, I think we are on a good path, and I can only say the future is exciting.
So let's move towards our audience and take some questions from them. If you have any questions for them regarding international borders, Burkina Faso. So the question from the audience is, you were talking about illegal mining, and she asked, what made the government turn a blind eye towards it? Yes.
I think that the Galamsey issue is very complicated. And the government have people involved in this Galamsey or illegal mining. So it's really difficult to operate. And sometimes they even go to the forest reserves and all that. And they go in at the blind eye of authorities. And so it's very complicated and difficult to handle.
Yeah, just to add up to what Devon is saying. See, the issue with Galamsey, I always talk with this with a bit of passion, but government has a big role, okay? If government says we are stopping all mining activity in the country, that will mean the status quo, okay? But now, government is not ready because, as they're only saying, they have their people involved in the activity itself. And that's their big cash cow. Yes,
so government has also played a role in carving this. It's not that they have not, but I think that they can do more because sending military to stop them and banning of excavators have been done. But I think we have to have more education, and they have to, I don't know, because it's a whole industry, the illegal mining, because some people, even the youth, are involved in this mining because they don't have jobs, because there's no jobs available. So if we blame the government, yes, but also even the youth in these areas are aware because it's their land and people come into those lands to mine. And so there's a lot of people who don't have jobs and they're also dealing in illegal mining. So,
it's a complicated issue. Well.
Okay, thank you so much, Delvin and Samuel, for sharing with us your realities and experiences of water struggles. It is inspiring to see your efforts in designing solution. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you too.
Thank you.
More information on this locally led organization can be found in the podcast description, including their social media handles. Thank you for joining us.